Hello, six pack of confidence. Been so many nights since we first met. Glad to see you brought all your friends for another night of Plastic Cup Politics.
Hello, good day, good evening, or however you press play on this bad boy. Welcome to a new episode of Plastic Cup Politics Podcast. I'm your host, Mark LaRue. He is Dr. Sean Hayes, PhD. That PhD is in political science. That's why we do this podcast. I have questions, he has answers, and we drink while we do it. You can interact with the show at Plastic Cup Pod on all your favorite social media sites. However you are listening to the show, go ahead and hit the subscribe button. That helps us out. And we're just going to jump right on into this. It's been a little bit since we did a podcast. We are recording on September 13th. It is Sunday night. And I will say, Dr. Sean Hayes, PhD, how you doing? What are you having?
I am doing well, sir. As well as can be expected. And I am drinking Samuel Smith's Organic Cider, produced from organically grown apples. So everything is local somewhere, right? This is a product of the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
Not super boozy. It's only 5%. It's really sweet, which, bizarrely enough, my wife just turned it down.
That's odd.
Yeah. Because it's basically drinking apple juice with a little booze in it, is what you're doing here.
Yeah.
But it's delicious. I like it.
In case you didn't know, one of his wife's favorite meals is Valentine's candy hearts and milk. So, also the only person that I've ever
cornstarch.
Yeah, also the only person I've ever known that actually eats gingerbread houses. Yeah, too sweet for her. That's kind of odd. And Samuel Smith, man, they do that. It's a very old traditional brewery. If you're looking for like a real ESB, or if you're looking for like kind of classic. The classic styles of beers, traditional styles of beers. Samuel Smith puts out some really solid ones. It is the first Sunday, football Sunday. So I accidentally started drinking at 10 o'clock and I've been drinking all day. And so as we record tonight, I am starting to get a hangover, which is pretty awesome. So I'm going to be drinking water, but I was drinking that brewery Strawberry Blonde and Road Rash IPA all day long. The Bears won, and I got to watch a no-hitter from the Cubs, which is pretty gosh darn rad. First no-hitter since Arrieta had one in 2016, but we will move on from there right into the podcast. And I said that we are a local politics and drinking podcast. On the local side of things, Kanye West is running for president. And he was making a big push here in Arizona to get on the ballot. You may remember Kanye West for his rap career and also for saying that slavery was a choice and palling around in a red MAGA hat with the president before he decided he was going to split off from there and run in Arizona. He's on like 9 ballots, I think, but he's trying to get on the Arizona ballot, paid a ton of money to get the requisite signatures, but was defeated in the court system here in Arizona by saying that you're not an independent if you're registered a Republican. Yeah. So he was kicked off the rolls here. But we've discussed this many times on the podcast, but I'm going to tease Dr. Sean Hayes, PhD, up one more time so you can just give us a little blurb about third-party candidates with the upcoming election.
So this is a rough example. There's a better one out there right now that we'll get to in like half a second. But so Kanye, right, has been coordinating with Jared Kushner on this whole thing. There's documented evidence that they've been meeting and having phone conversations with one another. So he's not seriously breaking away from Trump to run for president. He's running in the incredibly cynical hope that he can peel off a few young black voters who can't resist the urge to cast a hilarious ballot for Kanye.
Yeezy.
Yeah. So think about what that means. Kanye West and Jared Kushner and by extension President Trump think about black people. They think that black people, young black people, are so fucking stupid that they would look at a ballot that they have literally themselves defined as life or death and go, oh, well, fuck it, though, right? Like, I got to get a picture of me voting for Kanye. Really? That's how little they think of young black people in the United States. That's fucking pathetic. It is an indictment of his low character.
No matter how dope College Dropout was.
Yeah. And chalk one up for bizarrely enough, the good guys, the courts here in the good old state of Arizona.
Dr. Sean Hayes might not remember this, but Dr. Sean Hayes and I actually saw Kanye in 2005 in San Diego.
Oh, no, I remember.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember being as underwhelmed as I imagined I would be.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty dope. So anyway, win one for the good guys, and we will stick to our two-party system. Other than, who were you wanting to bring up?
Oh, so there has been yet another amazing development from the Supreme Court of the state of Wisconsin. So Wisconsin was getting ready to send out its ballots, its early ballots for voting by mail. It had a state statutory deadline of September 18th to print and mail all of its ballots, and a federal statutory deadline of September 19th to print and mail ballots to service members and their family who are overseas. And so most states, essentially, they peg their own mail-in ballot deadline, their own ballot printing deadline, to that federal deadline to get them to troops and their families serving overseas. It's not just troops; it's like foreign service, all sorts of stuff. But essentially, it's for people serving the United States of America overseas and their family to make sure that they're still able to vote. There's a statutory federal deadline that ballots have to be prepared and ready to mail by a certain date. In this case, it's September 19th. The Green Party in Wisconsin, one of its two candidates had half of her signatures, her or his, I can't remember now, it doesn't really matter, signatures thrown out in Wisconsin, and so they were removed from the ballot. And they sued. They cried sour grapes and decided to sue. And because elections are a political football for the Wisconsin Supreme Court, the Wisconsin Supreme Court took the case as opposed to laughing their fucking asses off, which is what real jurists would have done in the face of this argument. And they have now ordered the state government to produce a bunch of documentation. Documentation that will be almost impossible for the local voting precincts to actually provide by the deadline the Supreme Court has set. There is a good possibility that this court will invalidate all of those ballots and tell the state that they have to reprint them, which could very well put Wisconsin in a position where some voters do not get their ballots in time to fill them out and mail them back in time to be counted, which is something that Republicans would love to have be the case in a potential swing state like Wisconsin. This is what happens when you allow third parties to be taken seriously in a system that is designed for two parties. You end up with life or death elections that could very well be decided because the fucking Green Party VP candidate pitched a fit in Wisconsin because they didn't get their ballot, their signatures in properly to be added and kept on the ballot for this upcoming election. That should never be the case, ever.
I'm pretty sure that I know the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and I'm sure that they are a right-leaning Supreme Court, so I'm assuming that they're going into this for the express consent to play spoiler.
Yeah,
That's the whole idea. They have no interest in the legal merits of this case because there are no legal merits to this case. So it'd be laughable if they cited them, and they know it. This is all about the politics. What's funny is they've introduced a tiny note of conspiracy into the whole thing. And this has to be by design, because one of the discovery items they've asked for is all documentation around who gave the order to print these ballots. The suggestion there, of course, is that there is a conspiracy. And we are going to get to the bottom of the conspiracy of who ordered that these ballots be printed. Right? You set the stage that way, and the slavering idiots who are predisposed to believe you anyway will buy whatever you try to sell them next. And they know it.
Let's just go ahead and move on to another little news item that is a little bit old at this point, but of Donald Trump calling service members idiots and losers for serving and for dying. And as usual, we are getting the I never said that. And it just seems real hokey to say that, oh, I never said that, when we've known what you've said about John McCain. Like, he's one of the people that I hold in some esteem and who I have not agreed with, but who I have not been ashamed of representing me in Arizona. And we know what he said about John McCain. And so are we supposed to not believe that he called soldiers losers for dying? Because we know that he thinks that he likes his war heroes to not get captured.
Yeah.
Look, the best part about it, right, is that for the most part, no one outside of the right-wing blogosphere is seriously entertaining the idea that he didn't say this. Everyone else is just sort of going, yeah, no, he definitely said this. Or something very much like this. Because we've heard him fucking say it before. He literally said it about John McCain. He said he preferred heroes who don't get captured. Right? When challenged on the fact that he was berating the service of a man who was captured by the North Vietnamese during the Vietnamese war, during the Vietnam War, and held at the infamous Hanoi Hilton for 7 years.
I think five.
Feel free to fact check me on that. Yeah, five.
Yeah, so, I think five.
Too many years. Like,
right.
Lots of really brutal shit was done to him while he was there to try and break him. And so he was also a sort of an important moral voice in this country during the debate, if you'll recall, about torture in the years after the September 11th attacks. For exactly that reason, because he had in fact been tortured. We're talking about someone who has, you know, a certain amount of bona fides as a legitimate war hero. And when challenged on this, Trump doubled down and said, yeah, I prefer heroes that don't get captured.
And so that was alleged that he said that. We can just go ahead and move real quickly into shit that he definitely fucking said, because it's on the record. Here's a real good question. For a man that calls himself a stable genius, what you're going to do, like a bunch of recorded interviews with Bob Woodward, who took down Nixon? This is fucking ridiculous.
See, here's the thing. Like, I've been asking myself the same question, right? Like, wait, what the fuck do you mean there are tapes of him talking to Bob Woodward? What? How? Why would he ever say anything more than hello and goodbye to Bob Woodward? Not that Bob Woodward is a bad person, although I'm sure Trump certainly thinks of him as a bad person. But, like, he's Bob Woodward. He fucking brought down Nixon, the fucking Pentagon paper, all of it. Like, he's won Pulitzer Prizes for
for his work in dethroning an American president who was the last American president that pretended he would be a king, if you'll recall.
And Woodward has already written a fucking book that's been out for a couple years. Like, Jesus Christ, not a stable genius, I don't think.
Yeah, I don't understand it. So I think part of it might be that his ego demands that he believe some of his own bullshit. If he is a complete fraud, nothing is real, and he knows that it's not real, it's all a long con, then that means the man has zero self-esteem, right? He can't have self, because he knows it's all a lie. So, but we know that this guy has a renowned ego, right? Like, there's been thousands of pages of sort of gossip columnry written about it over the decades. He can't tolerate the idea that it's all a lie. So he incorporates bits and pieces of the lie into his sort of, you know, everyone has an individual narrative, right? History as it unfolded according to their view, their perspective. And we augment that narrative as we go along. Our brain does it unconsciously. It's part of how we see the world around us. We don't actually see everything all the time. There are bits and pieces of our visual map of the world around us that are filled in by our brain. There's all sorts of other corrective shit that's done to our view of the world before we sort of perceive it. The conscious us perceives it. Before we even get into the subject of the lies, well, I suppose we kind of have to touch on that a little bit before we can get into what I really want to say, right?
Because
we have to set that table.
And the biggest lie was that coronavirus wasn't a big deal. It's just the flu. When he told Woodward way before that it was terrible and it was five times as worse and that it goes through the air and it's not a touch thing. And he was talking about how terrible it was, but he says that on the phone, but in public, he was saying that it's just going to go away and it's just the same as the flu. The same as the senators who were privy to this information and who sold and got out of the market before the market crashed using that kind of information. These are things that the public should know about. I know that the president said that he didn't want to strike panic, but some of us are fucking adults and maybe you should treat us like adults.
The common rationale that I've seen pop up a couple of different places, defenders of the president saying you don't yell fire in a crowded theater, right? Because you don't want to incite a panic. No, that's not true. Actually, there is one circumstance under which not only should you yell fire, but you are morally and in some cases legally obligated to yell fire. And that's when the fucking theater is on fire.
Ding.
Yes. So, and the theater, ladies and gentlemen, is most certainly from like the basement boiler room to the projector room in the eaves. The theater is on fucking fire. So now is the moment to yell fire. So there is a little bit of a dissonance going on here that we are, in fact, allowing to happen. You and I actually played into it just now unconsciously. We totally didn't even notice we were fucking doing it. They're splitting the narrative in half, right? They're saying like, okay, we talked about it as if it was not a big fucking deal because we didn't want to incite a panic. And then they're just leaving it at that, as if that explains all of it. But talking about it is only half of what takes place. There's also, what did you fucking do about it? And they did nothing.
So that's the part they have to elude, right? They can't acknowledge that because it puts the lie to this whole we didn't want to incite a panic. Because if that was true, then what you would be saying is you would be offering calm, reassuring notes. You wouldn't be lying, right? Because that actually is more likely to incite panic. But you would be offering calm, reassuring, generic notes that over time become more specific as more details become available, or it becomes easier to provide those details without inciting a panic, right? This is how good leaders lead in a crisis, without revealing everything on day one and blowing up society, right? But while they're saying that and it's getting more and more specific gradually over time, they are also doing things over here that they're not talking about, but they are doing them. They are putting in place a national testing strategy and a national strategy to procure or produce the supplies necessary to make those fucking tests and process those fucking tests. They are providing the a national strategy to produce the infrastructure for tracking and tracing people who test positive and the people with whom they have come into contact. Right. These are the kinds of things they produce a national strategy to ensure that there are enough ventilators available in the various regions of the country as they cycle through spikes. Right. So starting in New York and San Francisco, because those were our two initial big hotspots, and then eventually migrating their way up and down the Eastern Seaboard and the West Coast, hitting Seattle and Washington. Right. That weird migratory pattern, there could have been a national strategy in place to ensure that respirator capacity followed that migration of peaks, right? And that infrastructure will continue to be incredibly useful because we are going to continue to see peaks migrating around the country. We're seeing it right now. The Midwest is now starting to spike, right? We started to see some plateauing here in the Mountain West and the South, although that plateauing has now – that may actually be slipping away from us at this point because a lot of places went back to school, and now we're starting to see some reversing of – and it wasn't even positive momentum. It was just we're reversing the lack of negative momentum. How fucking stupid is that? That's how finally we're splitting hairs at this point. We need to make sure that everyone continues to hold not only the Trump administration's feet to the fire, but everyone's feet to the fire about discussing this as one whole thing. What did you do/say about the coronavirus? Because just discussing what you said, I don't give a fuck about what you said. It's stupid. It's dumb. Right. You said stupid, dumb things, but we could recover from that and move on. That's not the fucking tragedy. Right. It contributed to the tragedy because it drove down rates of acceptance for mask wearing. Right. But it's not the tragedy. The tragedy is that they did nothing. That's what we need to make sure people keep coming back to.
As we've discussed on this show, me disparaging the VP debates, you know what? I think this one might be really good because guess who is in charge of the Corona Task Force? Mike Pence. That means Mike Pence knew about all of this. And Kamala Harris going at Mike Pence about this could be real good TV.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a reason why they picked a career prosecutor as the VP pick. It's not just that she ticked off a bunch of other boxes and made a lot of sense sort of overall politically in terms of their projected narrative arc for the campaign. It's also that they knew damn well that she was going to be incredibly effective at prosecuting the case against the Trump regime, particularly during the VP debates.
Yeah. Get your popcorn for that one.
Hell yes.
Moving on from that, a little pet peeve that I've been noticing, which is victim blaming. And I've been seeing a whole lot of it. The first, I mean, the one that I've noticed fairly recently was with the shooting of Jacob Blake here recently. The man who was shot 7 times in the back, is people talking about how he's a rapist. Maybe an alleged rapist, however you want to look at it. It's not that I don't care. It's that I don't really care in this context, because that's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about him raping a girl. And if he did, guess what? He needs to do his time. He needs to go to jail. He needs to, you know, serve the sentence for the crime. We're not talking about that. We're talking about him getting shot 7 times in the back. And it's the same with kind of, we were talking about the 6% COVID results. The people that were saying that the CDC was lying to us because only 6% of the people died of COVID, but the rest had pre-existing conditions. The COVID fucking killed them. And victim blaming them for having fucking diabetes isn't helping. On our Facebook page, I put up a video from Prescott Valley of a gentleman who led the police in a high-speed chase. He was driving the wrong way at 100 miles per hour, and he drove at a cop, and the cop, I was wrong. He was actually shot in the head, but barely. He just winged him in the head. Bad dude. And all kinds of bad shit. He was running from the cops because he was an illegal alien, he was a undocumented person who had a DUI and didn't want to be deported. All these things. Bad guy. Needs to serve his fucking punishment for this. The police pulled him over, and he was doing everything that the cops were telling him to do. Get on your knees, turn around, pull up your shirt, doing everything that he was told to. Cops tell him to get up, and they sick a fucking dog on him. And he is attacked by the dog, and they're telling him to roll, get back down on the ground and roll over and shit like that. Prescott Valley PD said that he hesitated. Well, there is body cam footage of this. It's on the Plastic Cup Politics Facebook page. Feel free to gander at it. See if you can see where he hesitated, because I didn't see it. And they're saying, well, look, all these, he was all doing all these things. Correct. He needed to go to jail. He did not need to be attacked by a dog. That's where I come to the victim blaming. And it just aggravates the living shit out of me that you want to bring up the old shit. You don't need to bring up the old shit. We're talking about this right here. You serve the fucking time for the shit you did beforehand. You see it all the time. Actually, pretty much every person, Rashard Brooks, I think they were, looking at his criminal past. Everybody, they try to look at their criminal past. Victim blaming. Dr. Sean has PhD. How do you feel about it?
I'm not sure that it's accurate to call it victim blaming, right? Because in the circumstances that we're talking about, that presumes that the person who is assigning blame believes that the other person is capable of being a victim under any circumstance. Part of what you are noticing isn't so much that they are attempting to misassign blame. It is that they are misassigning humanity. Yeah, that's what it is. It's an attempt to foreclose the space in which we might talk about those aspects of a person, their history, their personality, their psychological makeup, their socioeconomic background, that might offer an explanation for how they went from an innocent babe to having done whatever crime it is they've been convicted of doing, or that they're accused of doing in these cases, right? These people aren't even people who've been convicted of a crime. We in fact don't know if any crime indeed occurred in any of these cases, other than the crimes that were committed against them. But that whole discussion of blame or moral culpability requires that you acknowledge the humanity of the other person. Because only humans are capable of assigning or receiving blame. You don't, you know, if you have a faulty machine that kills one of your family members, you don't assign sort of moral and legal blame to the machine. You very well may go out and try and assign some amount of legal or moral blame to the people who designed and built the machine, but the machine itself is merely determined to be faulty and disposed of. To discuss blame attaching to the actual object, you have to believe that that object is a human being. And if they are a human being, and if the rights of humanity are endowed by their creator, and they share the same creator that you do, then they have the same rights that you do. And that's unacceptable to many of these people. So I think what you're seeing isn't necessarily an attempt to blame victims. It's to erase their ability to be victims in the first place. Right, I lay out all of these markers, right, that are important for other people who believe the same things that I believe. And these signifiers, having committed crimes, having lived in these certain places, having behaved in these certain ways, these signify your otherness, the fact that you are less than the fact that you are less. And so I lay all of these out not to assign blame, but to demonstrate for everyone that we don't need to talk about blame. This person just needs to be disposed of because they're not actually a human. They're faulty. Just get rid of them and we'll move on.
I don't think that you're wrong. Yes. Because, I mean, the classic... When I think of victim blaming, the classic victim blaming is rape victims and asking, well, what were they wearing? What were they doing wrong? Because it can't be, in the case of rape, it's not the man's fault. In all these cases, it can't be the police's fault. What happened to make them do that? And trying to find reason, backlogging, trying to find the reason for it and seeing them is not as valuable seems, rape, especially back in the day. Women were not seen as equal to men and that they had to have done something wrong for a man to act that way. These people must have done something wrong for the police to shoot them in the back 7 times.
Yes, 100%. Which leads me to sort of the next logical step. If you're trying to discuss this situation in its most naked and truthful terms, right? This mechanism of dehumanization.
So anyway, that's a plastic cup politics pet peeve, and try to fucking witness it and pay attention to it, because I have not gotten to this point yet, but I keep seeing people because with the NFL coming back into play, that people are putting names on helmets, and Blake's name is one of the names that's been on helmets. And there's some woman whose sister was raped by this guy and has to see that name on the helmet. I just want to say, what was she fucking wearing? And I know that that's not going to get a good reaction, but it's basically the same shit. So keep an eye out for that. And then I think we can pull this thing to a close and talk about all the fucking fires, man. It is fucking weird out. I went to go see the sunrise this morning, and I'm not a big Star Wars nerd. So what planet? Where was Tatooine. Luke Skywalker? Tatooine, the big red sun. That's what it looks like.
Yeah,
shit's crazy.
Yeah, it's even crazier up in Northern California. Our buddy Mo has been posting pictures on Facebook for the last week or two, and it's pretty nuts up there in the Bay Area. It's crazy that even here, in a circumstance where this sort of things should be far more straightforward, they aren't, and a lot of this. Right, a lot of what we're seeing happening right now in California is part and parcel of sort of the same the same trends that produced a lot of the lying we were discussing earlier in the show. The bizarre creation of alternative realities, including alternative realities in which you deny the humanity of the people that are sort of being victim blamed. We have the same thing sort of going on here, right? We have a couple of clear trends going on in communities, particularly in the Mountain West and along the West Coast. And Arizona is just as guilty of this as California, Oregon, and Washington, and we will ultimately end up suffering ourselves during our own fire season, which has been catastrophic here in the past and will be again in the future. There's a shrine to a bunch of young folks who didn't make it out of the last catastrophic wildfire we had here in Arizona. What's the name of do you remember the name of the hill, Mark?
The Yarnell
Hill. Yeah. So it's the top of Yarnell Hill. And there's a really interesting memorial up there. So we have a few clear trends going on here. It's interesting. So for a long time, the park services and sort of fire management services, but at both the federal and state level, operated under this model where they wanted to eliminate forest fires. We had that whole campaign with Smokey the Bear about only you can prevent forest fires, blah, 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 blah. And a lot of this was wrapped up in ideas around making sure that the land remained available for use and blah, blah, blah. You know, no one wanted to go and sort of recreate on burned parkland, et cetera, et cetera. But it was never really about, you know, if you think back to when we were kids, it was never really about, oh, there are a bunch of houses and people out there who are going to die. It's there are a bunch of trees and wildlife out there that are going to burn. And then some scientists came along and said, hey, look, dummies, you're talking about ecosystems that are designed to burn. There are plenty of species in the Mountain West and the West Coast of the United States that require their seeds have to be burned in order to germinate. And so by suppressing all of these fires, they were creating sort of a backlog of dead underbrush and sort of all of these prime conditions for these super forest fires where the fire like gets up into the treetops. And it becomes incredibly destructive because most forest fires, right, they're going to burn along the floor of the forest. The trunks of the trees will get a little blackened, but the tree here in the Mountain West, right, for pine forests, the pines themselves will be okay during a normal forest fire. When they get out of control, especially because there's a lot of built up fuel on the ground, they get up into the tops of the trees, and that's when things gets really nuts.
Yeah, that's when you start hearing about the 50, 60 foot flames.
Yeah. So we changed our policies and we started doing controlled burns and we started doing commercial clearing of underbrush, allowing companies to go in and clear out dead underbrush that they then reused for wood pulp and paper and fiber and all sorts of other stuff. So, you know, there was some good stuff that came out of those partnerships. And things started to improve dramatically. And then two counter trends smacked us in the face. One was climate change, and we started to see pretty dramatic shifts in when it got hot, how long it remained hot, and whether those hot, dry seasons corresponded, you know, sort of more or less with these tremendous winds that we get in the western United States, the Santa Ana winds coming in off the Pacific over California and other parts of the West. So climate change sort of threw us for a bit of a loop there, and state and local governments not only started allowing, whereas they used to prevent this, but encouraging not just individual homes, but communities to be built out in the trees, out in the forests. And so now we no longer have discussions now about, oh, this is a catastrophic wildfire. It's going to take decades for that forest to grow back.
Well, it's going to take decades for that forest to grow back, and 20 or 30 people are going to die, and thousands of homes are going to be burned to the ground, and hundreds of businesses are going to be burned to the ground, and hundreds of billions of dollars of damage are going to be done, if you include the economic losses that are going to rack up over the next few months as these communities are sort of taken offline. And these are all realities that, unfortunately, politicians on the right at the local, state, and federal level have insisted on denying over and over and over again. And they continue to insist on denying them. And that's the frustrating part, right, is that sadly, there's a hint of truth. All the best lies have a tiny bit of truth in them, right? And so there's a hint of truth. There is still some ongoing mismanagement here, but the mismanagement isn't on the part of the fire service. The mismanagement isn't a bunch of tree-hugging lefty liberals who don't want to see their favorite trees burn. The mismanagement is on the part of municipal and state governments that are hungry for more dollars from lobbyists paid by developers, large development corporations. Who are encouraging and passing the laws to facilitate the building of large communities out in the middle of forests that are designed to burn under normal circumstances. But now they've been in drought conditions for more than a decade in California, for almost 20 years here in Arizona. And we've got these, you know, the climate shifts being brought on by global warming. So, like, it's... You've got all of these things hitting all at once, and just like we were talking about earlier with COVID, the response is to deny, 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 attack. And unfortunately, unlike with COVID, that actually is not a novel response for this administration. There have been other American administrations over the course of the last 50 years that have also practiced that same sort of strategy whenever confronted with the realities of global warming, because they make lots of money from oil lobbyists. Or rather, I should say, they make lots of money becoming oil lobbyists after they leave office.
Well, there's definitely one thing we know about plastic cup politics. We always say follow the money, because that's usually where it leads, to the source. Yeah. Touch on COVID one more time. The president is saying that there's going to be might be a vaccine by election day. How say you, Dr. Sean Hayes, PhD?
Yeah, well, as we discussed at the beginning of the show, this is an individual that we now know for a fact has lied to you in the past about COVID-19. And this same person is lying to you now. There's not going to be a vaccine available by election day. If there is a vaccine available by election day, it won't be one that has been properly tested. And as we saw with the person in the AstraZeneca trial, which had to be halted, AstraZeneca is withholding the information from us. And keep in mind, by the way, we're not just sort of a hyper-interested public. We are their shareholders at the moment. We funded both the research and we pre-purchased the product that will result from that research. So we have a right to know, but we're being told they're just not going to reveal to us the details of what happened, other than it was severe neurological side effects. So it's not just, oh, they're going to push out a vaccine that gives a few hundred thousand people a rash. There's a very real possibility that if they do have a vaccine in public circulation by election day, it's the kind of thing that could give you permanent brain damage. I would just caution people to be incredibly, incredibly careful in the next couple of months, because this is the Trump administration has hinted repeatedly that they're hoping that this will be their October surprise is a vaccine. And I think it would be horribly dangerous, as bad as I want one.
Oh, that was about to say, here's my question. Am I crazy? Because I would sign up for a clinical trial on this.
You're not necessarily crazy because you're already sort of self-isolating. You are young and in relatively good health. I would be a little concerned because you don't have health insurance. So I would want to make sure that whatever agreement you signed, you know, was fairly generous in terms of how much they're going to pay for your health care if something goes wrong. That's something for everyone to consider when they're thinking about clinical trials like this. But no, so you wouldn't necessarily be crazy for signing up for a clinical trial, but that presumes that a real clinical trial is being held. There is no way on God's green earth they are going to be able to hold anything like a scientifically acceptable clinical trial of a vaccine between now and election day. Between now and a month from today, because they would need at least that much time to have a vaccine ready by election day, to have like the first batch of it ready to go. So even if you're being the most generous, right, you give him the benefit of the doubt. He was actually referring to the fact that the vaccine would just be sort of ready to start production by election day. Okay, fine. So they would need to have it ready between now and November 3rd, and there just isn't a way to responsibly hold a clinical trial that gets a vaccine to market in that amount of time.
Word. And I think that might be a podcast.
Hell yeah.
All right. I know you love this, so you can go ahead and hit the subscribe button, however the hell you're listening to this. And we do these sporadically, so that is the best way to check in on the show, is to subscribe. If you want to interact with the show, you can do so at Plastic Cup Pod on all your favorite social media platforms, and we will talk at you again whenever the hell we want to.
Hell yeah.
All right. Thanks, guys. Whoa!